America is the number one arms dealer in the world. Israel is 10th, and Israel's never going to be number one. They haven't got the size that America has as a massive global superpower. It was said to be so-called battle tested. In other words, it had been tested first on Palestinians. Everything from drones to killer machines to robot dogs. What Israel has done for years is to build relationships with a whole range of nations. In the Arab Muslim world, even nations that say they don't like what Israel's doing, they oppose to what's happening in Gaza, many of them have bought weapons from Israel. And I guarantee they will buy them again when this Gaza war ends.
All right, so hi everybody, welcome to another episode of Book Cafe Podcast. Today we will be speaking to Anthony Lowenstein, a prolific author and journalist based out of Sydney, Australia. And today we'll be speaking primarily about his 2023 book, The Palestine Laboratory: How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. So, Anthony, first and foremost, welcome to the show. It's really great to connect with you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. So, Anthony, let's just start out with some of the most pertinent questions. Why is the book called The Palestine Laboratory? Please help us understand that.
The reason I wanted to write this book was really to explain how I've been reporting on Israel-Palestine for over 20 years. I've been visiting there, reporting from there, lived there between 2016 and 2020 in East Jerusalem. And I spent a lot of that time reporting on the occupation, what it means for Palestinians under occupation, and that was interesting and important work. But what I was starting to see in the last 6, 7, 8 years was how so much of the technology and tools that Israel was using in Palestine that they've developed over decades to control millions of Palestinians was ending up around the world. It was being exported. And often when it was exported by Israeli government officials or Israeli companies, it was said to be so-called battle tested. In other words, it had been tested first on Palestinians. So I'm talking about anything from drones to spyware, which including in your country, Bangladesh, as you'd be well aware, there has been Israeli, even though Bangladesh and Israel are not official friends at all, there's definitely been quite a close relationship, in fact, between Bangladesh and Israel, amongst other states that Israel does not have official relations with. So I wanted to investigate that globally and explain to people how the laboratory is dangerous enough for Palestinians in Palestine, but it actually is an increasing global danger because Palestine itself and what's happening there is being exported. And as finally, we see this even in the most current situation with Gaza, where Israel is committing mass slaughter against Palestinians. And in the last 6 or so months since October 7, and history is any guide, you'll see that technology appearing in many, many other countries around the world in the coming months and years.
Right. Well, I think that the title of the book is really quite ominous. And having read the book, I can say that it's just a scary title in and of itself, but the details are even more scarier. So you mentioned robot dogs, you mentioned weapons, you mentioned spyware. I'd like to just make a comparison here between Gaza and the West Bank. Would it be fair to say, Anthony, that Gaza is actually the weapons testing lab, whereas the West Bank is the lab for testing the spyware? Your thoughts on that, please.
It's not quite as neat as that. I suppose just for listeners who aren't quite aware, Gaza, obviously putting aside what's happened in the last 6 months since October 7, has essentially been under Israeli and Egyptian siege for 17 years, which meant that there's about 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza. It's often very hard to get out if you're a Gazan, if you're a Palestinian. The border crossings often are not open very much. So it almost gives Israel, and Gaza is a very small area. There's 2.3 million Palestinians packed into a tiny area. Some people will have seen the footage in the last months that a lot of Palestinians who are now refugees within their own country, essentially, because their homes have been destroyed, they're being moved around all the time by Israeli forces. So over the years, Israel has been testing huge amounts of weapons. Like when you go to Gaza, I've been visiting there for the last, I was first there in 2009. You always heard the sound of drones in the air 24/7. Just kind of hum buzzing in the background. Often you saw them above you. And there's been a range of surveillance technologies, sophisticated walls, which Israel had deployed. Of course, it's important to say that on October 7, it all failed. I mean, there's no other way to view that, that Hamas was able to successfully knock out with relatively simple technology, very sophisticated technology, and Israel was essentially blinded after that. So yes, I think there's been spyware tested in Gaza too, and the West Bank. West Bank is a larger area. There's more people there, more Palestinians, and of course also Jewish settlers or colonists. But I think in general, Israel has viewed Gaza particularly as a unique place to test weapons and surveillance because it's relatively small and contained, and very few people were going in and out of the borders because of those huge restrictions imposed by Israel and Egypt.
And just staying with that point, Yanti, how damaging has the attacks on October 7th been to Israel, given that they've marketed themselves as a security country, a country that's able to provide weaponry as well as spyware and software to help countries counter-terrorism. So has it been damaging to the Israeli brand, do you think?
I guess it depends who you ask. I mean, if you're rational, the answer would have to be yes. It should be yes. But I've seen not much evidence of that so far. And what I mean by that is that, yes, October 7 was an intelligence, military, political catastrophe for Israel, quite clearly. Hamas were able to infiltrate Israel for hours and hours and hours. In some cases, there were Hamas fighters in Israel for days. It was a complete intelligence, military catastrophe from the Israeli perspective. But there's every indication because Israel, as soon as October 7 happened, was essentially going into Gaza. They didn't send ground troops until the end of October, but there was military response from October 7, that Israel has been using overwhelming force in Gaza and not talking much anymore about what happened on October 7, that many of the nations that would have been interested in Israeli military assets, spyware, surveillance tech, don't seem, at least so far, to be put off by what happened on October 7. And for example, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, many, many European nations came to Israel almost begging for missile defense shields and other kind of defense equipment. Israel can sold it to them in huge numbers. I don't see October 7 changing that. I think the war in Ukraine is still going on. It's still very bloody and ugly. And many European countries are still coming to Israel for help. Many Arab countries, Israel's neighbors, Palestine's neighbors. It's worth saying this because since October 7, none of them have cut ties. They've recalled ambassadors and they've expressed concern. But the truth is that they won't cut ties because the latest figures that we have for Israeli weapons, which are from 2022, we'll get the figures from last year soon. It was $12.5 billion that Israel sold globally. 24% of that were to Arab autocracies in their region. So Saudi, UAE, Bahrain, etc. And they're buying surveillance and repressive technology to repress their own people because they fear their own people, essentially. And I don't see that changing. In fact, if anything, I suspect that many people in the Arab world, understandably, are unbelievably angry with what their own countries have been supporting, these so-called normalization deals with Israel. And in some ways, I suspect these countries are going to want to buy more repressive technologies to repress their own people even more. So I'm not going to say there are no countries that will choose not to buy Israeli surveillance and repressive technology. I've seen no evidence for it so far. And I'm moderately confident that many, many other nations are watching Israel live testing new weapons in Gaza now. And Israel is already, by the way, marketing those. There's been two major global arms fairs in the last 6 months, one in Paris and one in Singapore, quite close to where you are. And Israeli companies were there, Elbit, particularly the main Israeli defense company. And they were promoting some of the things they'd been using in Gaza. Now, it's unclear yet who was actually buying that equipment, so we don't know that yet. But there's no shame so far from Israel's perspective in trying to promote it as battle tested in Gaza. So I think many nations, despite finally what they say, they're outraged by what Israel's doing. As I always say, look what a country does, not what it says. And I suspect
Right.
many of those nations will end up buying some of that equipment.
Yeah, definitely. And so, in other words, actions speak louder than words. I mean, you can have all the
Yes.
rhetoric, but at the end of the day, if you're not actually taking concrete steps to do something about a particular country's relationship with Israel, it's all just hot air. So,
Exactly.
exactly. So, one of the things that I really appreciate about the book, Anthony, is how much new information I was able to learn. I really appreciate any book that teaches me something new. And one of the myths that I
Thank you.
had before reading the book was the fact that Israel was a pariah state that nobody likes. But after you, once you wrote all this information in the book, it seems as though that's really not the case because they
Not the
have
case.
exactly. So perhaps you could elaborate more on that as exactly how Israel, being the world's weapons manufacturer as well as security equipment dealer, has actually transformed itself from a pariah state to a essential state, or a state that everybody wants to get on the good side of. So your thoughts on that, please.
Obviously, if you speak to many people in, say, the Muslim world, this is before October 7, but certainly since, some of them will say, as you just said before you thought this, it's a pariah state. It's only got a few friends, America, some in Europe, maybe my country, Australia, Western states, which is simply not true. What you find when you look into this issue, and I'm glad you say that, I appreciate those words because the book has done extremely well globally for so many people who did not know this history and even the present day, because a lot of people I think know something about the US involvement with repressive states since World War II, involving Washington in some of the most repressive regimes in the last 70, 80 years. What is so much less known is the Israeli involvement, which often has been the same, if not more. The US is a superpower. I'm not comparing the two. US is still much more powerful than Israel. America is the number one arms dealer in the world. Israel is 10th, and Israel's never going to be number one. They haven't got the size that America has as a massive global superpower and the population. But what Israel has done for years, pretty much soon after its birth in 1948, is to build relationships with a whole range of nations, nations they have official ties with, and many they do not, across the Arab and Muslim world, just as much as I mentioned before. In the Arab Muslim world, even nations that say they don't like what Israel's doing, they oppose to what's happening in Gaza, say many of them have bought weapons from Israel. And I guarantee they will buy them again when this Gaza war ends. And I say that because what Israel has done for years, for decades really, is to almost use its arms industry as an insurance policy. On the one hand, yes, it's to make money, and Israel's making a lot of money from the arms trade. That's obviously part of it. But it's also, particularly since 1967, when the Six-Day War, Israel took control of the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the Sinai. Very much soon after that, Israel has been really selling the idea of how to fight a so-called counterinsurgency war for more than half a century now, going to countless nations around the world, arming, training, funding, backing, supporting countries, some conflicts you will have heard of, many will not have. I estimate in the book, I think, and we don't even know the exact number, but anywhere in the last decades that Israel will have sold some form of surveillance technology, weapon to anywhere between 125 and 140 nations on the planet, which is the majority. I think the UN has got roughly 190 countries. So it's the majority, a sizable majority of countries on the planet. Democracies and dictatorships. And the easy, simple, and I would argue wrong perception now would be after October 7, the Israeli response, the mass slaughter of tens of thousands of Palestinians would be surely now is the time that Israel will be a pariah. And I would question that analysis again. It depends who you ask. Let's be clear. In the last 6 months, the entire Western world has supported Israel, still is. The US has. Not all of Europe, but most of it has. Australia, my country has. Every Western country pretty much has. Now, Westerners in those countries often have not, but I'm saying Western elites have, many in the media have. Now, obviously, if you go to the Arab street, if you go to, I suspect, many people in your country, Bangladesh, they will equation. So, what I'm saying to people is now we need to actually build on this outrage and take it into practical action. Arms embargoes, sanctions, all those kinds of things that in general do not come from politicians. They come from the ground up. So we need to be demanding that of our own leaders, including in many countries where they have in the past, and I suspect in the future they will try to buy more Israeli repressive technology.
Yeah, indeed, for sure, for sure. And you've mentioned Bangladesh a couple of times, Anthony. So we'll definitely have to come to South Asia and talk about a couple of
Yes.
countries in addition to Bangladesh. So let's start with India. As you well know, that in 1947 and 48, when both India and Pakistan and Israel became independent, India and Israel didn't actually have the most warmest of relations. But that changed recently with the advent of Mr. Modi's election in 2014 and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in 2009. So, what exactly is the driving force behind the bromance between Prime Ministers Modi and Netanyahu? Please tell us more about that.
Before I get to that, just one brief interlude. There was a recent some new declassified documents in Israel which appeared in the last few months in Hebrew, which are being translated into English. And it shows that, in fact, for decades, even though India and Israel were not particularly close before Modi came in 2014, there was a relationship between Israel and India, but it wasn't close. What India had been doing for years was actually romancing the Hindu fundamentalists in India, which on the face of it seems crazy, considering the fact that they're a Jewish state. Why are they romancing people who are pretty crazy and extreme? And it was seen as the so-called justification for that in these documents was, well, the official Indian position is quite hostile to us as Israel, more aligned with, back in the day, the Soviet Union, more critical stance on Israel-Palestine, whereas Hindu fundamentalists are more aligned with Israel and their worldview. Fast forward to 2014, Modi became prime minister, has been there now for 10 years. As you know, he's facing an election this year, almost certainly will win. There's not really much of an opposition anymore, so almost certainly he'll get a third term. And during the last 10 years, a few things have happened. One, India has bought massive amounts of defense equipment from Israel. But the relationship is not just about money. Yes, Israel's making a lot of money out of this, but it's not just that. It's more than that. It's an ideological alignment that Modi is trying to build, scarily, a Hindu fundamentalist nation in India. And it's been given kind of a carte blanche by the West to do so because they're not China, and therefore the West is aligning themselves with India. And Israel itself is obviously built a Jewish fundamentalist state for Jews in their own territory. And that alignment to me, as I say in the book, reminds me of Israel and South African apartheid back in the day, before apartheid ended in 1994, which was partly a defense relationship, but also an ideological alignment. That South African apartheid admired what Israel was doing to Palestinians, and Israel deeply admired what they would do, South Africa was doing to its black population. It's very similar with India and Israel, to the point where you have many Indian officials, including since October 7, but long before, praising the occupation of Palestine, supporting Israel's war on terror on Palestinians. Indian officials have openly said that they admire what Israel is doing in the West Bank, and they have visioned something similar for Kashmir, which obviously is the Muslim majority part of India. And I think that kind of alliance between Israel and India is something that we should be more concerned about, because in some ways what India and Israel are doing are being kind of leaders globally of a loose coalition of far-right actors. And what I mean by that is, when you have a increasingly Hindu fundamentalist party in the BJP in India, not all Indians, of course, but many Indians are very supportive of that. It's mirroring what you see in parts of Europe and the West, where many far-right parties and groups who are traditionally hostile to Jews, anti-Semitic, sometimes neo-Nazi background, are increasingly supporting Israel. And that's only, in fact, increased since October 7, where you have far-right groups in Italy and France and Sweden, groups who traditionally don't like Jews, who are literally have a neo-Nazi background. You'd think groups that Jews would run a mile from, or Israel would run a mile from, in fact, they're welcoming them. And that kind of alliance, I think, needs to be not just exposed but talked about, because it's pretty petrifying. And it makes all of us, and I'm Jewish myself, although I'm not religious, makes all of us more unsafe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I was quite surprised to hear, even during the Capitol Hill riots and the rally, the Israeli flag was also quite prominent. And these are people that you'd associate with traditionally having been very anti-Semitic and highly right-wing and etc. But the white nationalists, I suppose, as you said, that they admired that about Israel. Let's talk about a couple of other South Asian countries, specifically Myanmar and Bangladesh, Anthony. As we all know, that in 2017, the Myanmar military junta committed a genocide and an ethnic cleansing against its Rohingya population. How complicit has Israel's role been in the 2017 genocide in that we saw in Myanmar? Please tell us about that.
Very. That's the short answer. The longer answer is, I mean, ultimately, it was not Israelis committing the crimes, the actual killings and displacement. But what you found in Myanmar, and this was, by the way, happening before the genocide in 2017, 18, and even after, is that Israel was selling a lot of surveillance equipment and weapons to the Myanmar junta. Again, this goes back a long time. This goes back when they were a dictatorship years ago. This continued when they were sort of a quasi democracy, although I would argue not much, when Aung San Suu Kyi was the leader. I mean, it was still not very democratic, but it was compared to now, it was. And then Aung San Suu Kyi is overthrown whenever that was, 3, 4 years ago, have to correct me when that was, and is now back to a dictatorship again. And even when it was known that the Myanmar regime had committed genocide, Israel was still selling surveillance equipment to the regime. And, this was based, I explain this in the book through documents and evidence and witnesses and contracts that have come out in parts of the Israeli press about what Israel was selling. So to be clear, Myanmar was doing what it was doing. Would it have done it without Israel? It's hard to say, possibly, but it was Israeli involvement and support was important to both before the genocide and afterwards. And again, like in so many cases, Rwanda 1994, when there was an actual genocide being committed, Israel was supporting the parties committing the genocide. Sri Lanka in 2009, that might not have been a genocide, but it was certainly, although some Tamils would say it was, but a form of mass slaughter of Tamils at the cessation of that civil war. Israel was supporting the Sri Lankan government for years in arming, funding, and helping them to fight their so-called war on terror. So the irony of a Jewish state that was established in the ashes of a Holocaust against Jews to now be over decades supporting other genocides in a range of other countries, and now in Gaza committing a genocide, is so dark and so grim, and as someone Jewish, very shameful.
Yeah, certainly. And I have to say that the Israel's complicity in both 2017 as well as in the Sri Lankan civil war, those were extremely eye-opening, and I had no idea before reading the book. So I think that these points of information is what makes the book so valuable and a fascinating read. So,
Thank you.
Anthony, as we're coming towards the end of our show, I wish I could extend this discussion for another half hour, but I want to hold myself to the half an hour that we had promised before we started. So let me just end
Okay.
with a couple of staple questions that we love to ask all of our guests. As you know, that our show is called Book Cafe Podcast, so the word book is in the title. So we have a couple of staple questions specifically with regards to books. So the first staple question is, are you more of a fiction person or a nonfiction person? What genre of books do you enjoy reading?
I am nonfiction in that way. I'm very stereotypically, and not that men don't read fiction, but I know that more women do, unfortunately. So I read much more nonfiction, for better or worse.
Okay, no worries. So we'll take your answer as it is. And the second staple question that we love to ask our guests, and I'm told that it's a really tough question, but given that you're such an avid reader and writer, I'm sure you can give us a very good answer to it. And the question is, if you could select a book that you feel that every young person should read at least once in their lifetime, it may or may not be a book related to history or to geopolitics, but if you could pick a book that is both edifying and useful, what would be your pick?
Well, the book actually, I think, is sitting behind you, which is fiction, is 1984 by Orwell, which I read, I think, first when I was a teenager. I can't remember when. Now, obviously, that's not it's not journalism. I mean, he obviously, Orwell was a
Is very
journalist,
prescient,
a writer. And I feel like reading that book for me, Orwell, I think, would be, his mind would be blown where the surveillance of the world is today. It was unimaginable when he wrote that book 60, 70 years ago. So I would say everyone should read that book and a lot of other Orwell. I think Orwell is a real beacon for many people who write journalism and fiction. And yeah, to me, the best writers, fiction or non-fiction, engage with the world. Now, obviously, everyone can write whatever they want to write, but to not engage in some way with the real world as it exists, I would argue, is a dereliction of duty, in my opinion. So I would say 1984.
Okay, wonderful. So I'm really glad I had the book up here because that was going to be my last question for today. That do you believe that we've already stepped into an Orwellian dystopian world? And I believe that given the answer that you just gave us, that is fair to say that even if we're not exactly there yet, we are taking, steps
Well, yeah.
towards that kind of dystopian society. Okay, so on that
Yes.
note, for our viewers and listeners who have been with us all this time, thank you very much for staying till the end. If you're watching this episode on YouTube, please be sure to put a subscribe to the channel and put a like on this video. Let's try and get Anthony's book up to as many people as possible. And definitely do be sure to pick up the book. It's a fabulous book. I cannot praise it enough. And the book, once again, is The Palestine Laboratory by Anthony Lowenstein, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. Anthony, my thanks to you as well, my friend. You've been a wonderful guest. I've really enjoyed talking to you. And I really hope to have you back
Likewise.
for a future episode. Thank you very much. Really
Thank you.
appreciate it.
And thanks for the opportunity. It was great to meet you. Thank you.